It is Monday, May the 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, what to do about the tensions over North Korea's missile and nuclear program. Also ahead, President Trump inviting to Washington Philippine leader Rodrigo Duterte.
Mr. Duterte has previously spent very little, if any, time in the U.S., so one hopes that his visit will be a chance to observe our society, to interact with Americans.
The People's Climate March, plus the 100th anniversary of Ella Fitzgerald's birth. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Appearing on U.S. TV news program Face the Nation, President Trump on Sunday was asked about the tensions between the U.S. and North Korea over Pyongyang's missile and nuclear programs and the ongoing test of each ordered by President Kim Jong-un.
I would not be happy if he does a nuclear test. I will not be happy. And I can tell you also, I don't believe that the president of China, who is a very respected man, will be happy either.
Mr. Trump was also asked about recent comments he made in which he expressed a level of admiration for Kim Jong-un.
People are saying, is he sane? I have no idea. I can tell you this, and a lot of people don't like when I say it, but he was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father, when his father died. He's dealing with obviously very tough people, in particular the generals and others. And at a very young age, he was able to assume power. A lot of people, I'm sure, tried to take that power away, whether it was his uncle or anybody else. And he was able to do it. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie. But we have a situation that we just cannot let. We cannot let what's been going on for a long period of years continue.
And as we heard earlier, China is at the center of Mr. Trump's push to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula and to create more jobs in the U.S. economy. Both issues appear to be wrapped together, as VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman is following the developments and shares now what he's seen with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Donald Trump made a very interesting claim just a few hours ago on national television. He claimed that, in fact, China's persistent devaluations of its currency have already ended, that they ended during the campaign, and that it was his rhetoric during the campaign that sent the message to Beijing, and Beijing acted as a result of what he was saying during the campaign. I will leave it to other minds to say whether that is true or not. I think that there's a healthy amount of skepticism about that claim here in Washington. But nevertheless, China has definitely gone from the whipping boy during the campaign to not necessarily an ally of Donald Trump, but sort of in the realm of the enemy of my enemy must be my friend.
And I think on the economic front, he has learned that it's a very complicated relationship between the United States and China.
In addition to individual things, I mean, America sells a fair number of automobiles to China, would love to sell more in addition to airplanes and all sorts of things. There are questions, long-term questions concerning intellectual property, what gets stolen. But let's not forget that China holds trillions of dollars of U.S. debt and that, in essence, the United States is able to sustain its indebtedness and its chronic inability to put its financial house in order, thanks to the fact that China year after year snaps up and purchases America's debt. China is the biggest holder of U.S. debt. And I suspect that so long as that is the case, that China will have a certain amount of sway. Not to mention the fact that it is among the biggest market of consumers out there. And certainly you do not want to pursue policies where you are cutting yourself off to well over a billion people.
Well, you want to talk about protectionism. A lot of people have accused Donald Trump of being a protectionist. China is probably one of the biggest protectionist markets out there. So many international companies, particularly from the United States, have complained about being able to do business in China. It is so difficult from the rules and regulations and whether or not, you know, the Chinese even want products from the outside. China has made a few superficial moves, investments in the United States. States. Jack Ma of Alibaba reached out to Donald Trump and suggested that perhaps his company can sell some food from the Midwest back to China or at least to Asia markets. So there is a little bit of movement there.
There is. The relationship between Washington and Beijing has been complicated for a very long time. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember when, in fact, Nixon opened the door between these two countries. And certainly, I mean, while China has opened itself up to the trappings of capitalism, officially it is still a communist state and it maintains very strict controls over the means of production. So the relationship has always been complicated. And just in geostrategic terms, China is a country that has been economically growing by leaps and bounds for a very long time. I suspect that it feels that it can exert a certain amount of influence on the world stage. It is very much of a rising power, and no one should be surprised that in certain realms that there are going to be challenges that arise between the United States and China.
And, of course, we haven't even touched anything like the South China Sea.
This brings up a whole list of questions. I mean, if Donald Trump is banking on China to bring down the hammer on North Korea and really force it to change its ways, beyond whether or not China is a currency manipulator, does this mean that the United States looks the other way in the South China Sea? Does this mean that the United States mutes the voice that it has had in recent years concerning China's human rights conditions? To just how far does this accommodation go? And I suspect that that will be determined by what China is actually able to accomplish in North Korea. Clearly, the Trump administration is giving Beijing a certain amount of rope to deal with. But I suspect that if it proves to be fruitless, that rope will be retracted.
As they say, stay tuned. We'll be back next week with further developments. Michael Bowman is our VOA Senate correspondent. Thank you so much, Michael.
Always a pleasure.
And many thanks to you, gentlemen. You know, the White House is defending President Trump's invitation to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to visit Washington, saying the need to fortify an Asian alliance against North Korea's growing military threat outweighs concerns about Mr. Duterte's domestic crackdown on drug trafficking. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked East-West Institute senior fellow Gerard Finnan if this means heated relations between Washington and Manila are cooling down. He says, yes, somewhat.
I think there are three potentially positive dimensions to the story. The first is that it's important always to keep high-level channels of communication open with our alliance or treaty partners, of which the Philippines is one. The second potentially positive dimension of this story is that thus far, U.S. efforts to encourage Mr. Duterte to respect the rule of law in the Philippines and respect international norms for human rights have been highly unsuccessful. And as many people know, more than 3,000 people have died during the period of time when Mr. Duterte has been in office. So this visit, when it takes place, will give Mr. Trump an opportunity to convey to Mr. Duterte the same message that he sent to President Bashar al-Assad of Syria about indiscriminately killing civilian populations. And if Mr. Trump so chooses, it's possible for him to be a positive and moderating influence on Mr. Duterte. The third element of the communication, I think, is that Mr. Duterte has previously spent very little, if any, time in the U.S. So one hopes that his visit will be a chance to observe our society, to interact with Americans, and come to understand that even though we have our own drug problems and problems with drug addiction here in the United States, drug treatment works and is preferable to the policy he's currently pursuing, which has resulted in the deaths of thousands of Filipinos.
Well, Mr. Trump has spoken with leaders of Japan and South Korea, of course, a number of times, dispensing even his vice president, Mike Pence, to the region, meeting with these leaders. But he's also reaching out to the leaders of Thailand and Singapore. Is the U.S. lining up a large coalition to present a united front against North Korea?
It's a little bit too early to tell for sure, but the fact that the Trump administration is reaching out, having important conversations, and attempting to keep the lines of communication open among some of our strongest partners in the region is something that I think is a positive development.
Does Mr. Duterte remain popular despite in the Philippines, despite what's going on with regard to the drug program?
I believe that his popularity has declined a bit as people come to see that human rights are something that need to be respected, and the rule of law is something that needs to be followed. Although initially he was quite popular, I think there has been some decline in recent months as people came to see how indiscriminate the killings were.
In comments Saturday, Mr. Duterte urged President Trump to back off a bit on North Korea, trying not to be quite so confrontational. Will that advice be taken?
Well, it's hard to say, but the fact that they're talking and thinking about these things is certainly positive. It's not the case that Mr. Duterte has an awful lot of experience in international relations, nor does Mr. Trump, of course. But if they're listening to their advisors and finding ways in which to lower tensions, that's always positive.
From your vantage point, has Mr. Duterte's policies changed at all while he's been in office? Is he still full steam ahead in this drug program?
Well, there was some moderation of the program after the murder of the Korean businessman. But in recent weeks, it seems that the Philippine National Police have been very active. So I think there's still a long ways to go before we can say that the rule of law is being followed in the Philippines and that people are getting a fair trial before they are executed.
Have you heard of any more talk about abrogating a defense alliance between the two countries?
No, and that's another, I think, positive development in that if Mr. Duterte and Mr. Trump are able to see the mutual advantages of maintaining our alliance relationship, and I think that bodes well for the future.
Gerard Finnan is a senior fellow at the East-West Institute, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Zambia. Will President Edgar Lungu declare a state of emergency after public buildings were torched in attacks? He blames the violence on opposition members protesting the arrest of their leader, Hakainde Hichilema. An in-depth discussion on Zambia on the next Straight Talk Africa.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thousands of environmental activists marched in Washington and hundreds more in cities across the country and around the world trying to draw attention to climate-related causes. The People's Climate March, as it was called, was meant to coincide with President Trump's 100th day in office. According to its organizers, who have condemned what they see as the administration's lack of concern for environmental issues and Congress's lack of attention to the same issues. International Edition's Lori London speaks with Jeffrey Gracer, an environmental attorney with the New York firm Sive, Paget, and Reisel, who took part in the weekend march.
People were really fired up. There were over 200,000 people in D.C. and many, many more at sister marches around the country and around the world. People are very focused not just on marching, but on pressing for solutions to climate change. And the fact is that there are many solutions at hand that simply need to be implemented. I think it was important for people to be in Washington to make that point. But a lot of what's happening in the climate change realm right now is happening outside of Washington, and there's a recognition that these protest marches, while important, are probably not going to influence the president or this Congress, but will send the message that there are people out, many, many people out there in all walks of life who want solutions to climate change and not continued denial.
Well, the administration is overhauling the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency's website, to what it says reflect its new policies. What do we know about what they're doing?
Well, I think all we know at the moment is that they're removing references to climate change subject to some future review. But to me, it's reminiscent of you know, book burnings or burning ancient libraries. I mean, this is science. If they want to put up other information that's been peer-reviewed that contradicts what the thousands of peer-reviewed scientists have already concluded, that's one thing. I don't think that eliminating the words from a website is going to accomplish much.
Well, the march also coincided with President Trump's 100th day in office. He does seem very focused on climate issues and reversing his predecessor's policies. He says it's to create jobs. Do you believe that he's on the right track with that?
No. If he wants to create jobs, he should be promoting renewable energy jobs, which are the fastest growing sector of jobs in the energy space. That would create a lot of good local jobs, including in coal country. Recently, a coal mining company announced a very, very large solar project on one of their sites. That's what he should be promoting right now.
Also, some other environmental issues that came up with this administration on Friday, last Friday, president signed an executive order to allow offshore drilling in what is currently protected areas of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans. So that was quite a big deal for environmentalists.
I think it'll be interesting to see whether the economics support that kind of activity. There is a growing recognition that conventional drilling on land and not in sensitive water environments is more profitable. It remains to be seen, first of all, whether these executive orders will be challenged or whether subsequent regulatory efforts will be challenged in the courts. I expect they will. But I also question whether the economics of conducting activities in those areas will lead to significant levels of activity. I think in terms of the Atlantic, most people would rather see wind projects than oil drilling.
You mentioned the Court of Appeals, which Friday issued a ruling that would appear to make it easier for the president to scrap President Obama's Clean Power Plan. Where does that stand?
Well, that decision really related to a narrow question of whether the rule should be remanded to the EPA for further consideration. So it doesn't in and of itself make it easier. In addition, EPA has already found that greenhouse gases endanger public health and the environment, and under a Supreme Court decision, once it's done that, it's legally obligated to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So this is far from over in terms of how the ultimate rulemaking proceeding will go and subsequent litigation.
And for folks out there that are concerned about the threat of climate change and the future and want to address the impacts, what can you tell people to give them some hope despite the current administration's policies when it comes to environmental and climate issues?
I think there's a lot of reason for hope. And there's a recent book by Mayor Bloomberg called Climate of Hope, which is a good read, which talks about how states and cities and business will be leading the effort to address climate change, notwithstanding the absence of leadership in Washington. Recently, 16 Fortune 500 companies sent a letter to the president asking that we remain in the Paris Agreement. That's 16 companies with a combined market capitalization of $3.4 trillion. So business understands that this issue has to be addressed. In addition to that, I think we're beginning to see newly minted activism, not only in environmental groups, but in the corporate sector. There are a lot of people within corporations who want to see action on climate. And those people are a very powerful force. And every citizen in America who has a job can talk about this issue within their companies. And there's a growing recognition that that kind of grassroots activism in the private sector, not just with environmental groups, but from people in the business community, is a force that will have to be reckoned with.
That is environmental lawyer Jeffrey Grazer speaking with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Here's some troubling news for people who have anything but type O blood. According to a new study, if your blood type happens to be either type A, B, or AB, you're at a higher risk of a heart attack. The study's findings are based on an analysis of reports of cardiovascular events such as heart attack, coronary artery disease, ischemic heart disease, and heart failure. The reports were divided into two groups, those with type O blood and those with other blood group types. The study found that odds of non-O blood type carriers experiencing all types of coronary events were significantly higher than the group with type O blood. But the analysis also reveals that when it came to fatal coronary events, there was no significant difference between people with type O and non-O blood groups. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for something from the world of music and entertainment.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do I, 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 do I. It don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is sing. Do I, 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 do I.
They called her the First Lady of Song, or sometimes the Queen of Jazz. Always known as Lady Ella, Ella Fitzgerald was a powerhouse in the music business for more than 60 years.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do what I do. Don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is sing. Do what I do.
Ella Jane Fitzgerald was born in 1917 in the U.S. state of Virginia. Her family later moved to New York City. And then, in 1934, the 17-year-old jazz vocalist made her singing debut during an amateur night at the Apollo Theater. Ella had many big hits, including this one, It Don't Mean a Thing. In recent days, family and friends and fans from all over the world have been celebrating the life and career of the famed singer on the 100th anniversary of her birth.
Somewhere there's music, how faint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon. There is no moon above when love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me as I love you. Somewhere there's music, it's where you are. Somewhere there's heaven, how near, how far. The darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. Until you will, I'll steal my heart. How high the moon. High the moon is the name of the song. How high the moon, though the words may be wrong. We're singing it because you ask for it. So we're swinging it just for you.
Ella Fitzgerald's three octaves range and her impeccable diction, phrasing, and intonation made her one of the biggest American singers of all times, evidenced here in her big hit, How High the Moon.
High, 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 high is the moon.
In February of 1960, Fitzgerald performed live at the Deutschlandhalle in Berlin. Among the many songs she sang that night was Mack the Knife, which was a big hit for both Louis Armstrong and Bobby Darin.
Oh, the shark has pearly teeth, dear. And he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has MacHeath, dear. And he keeps it out of sight.
Fitzgerald had suffered from diabetes for several years of her later life, which had led to numerous complications. In 1996, she said she was tired of being in the hospital and she wanted to go home. She died there in Beverly Hills, California, on June 15, 1996, at the age of 79.
Could it
pretty sure we can forgive her forgetting the lyrics, huh? How about that? Amazing, Ella Fitzgerald. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Coming up, the latest world news. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now, a bit more of Ella singing Mack the Knife.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is shocked and deeply saddened by the death of a U.S. citizen serving as a paramedic with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, Special Monitoring Mission. The paramedic was killed when his vehicle struck an explosive in separatist-controlled territory in eastern Ukraine. Acting State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said the death underscores the increasingly dangerous conditions under which these courageous monitors work, including access restrictions, threats, and harassment. The United States urges Russia to use its influence with the separatists to allow the OSCE to conduct a full, transparent, and timely investigation. Since its establishment in 2014, the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission has played a vital role in overseeing the Minsk agreements designed to bring peace to eastern Ukraine. This incident makes clear the need for all sides, and particularly the Russian-led separatist forces, to fully implement their commitments under the Minsk agreements immediately. This includes a real and durable ceasefire, withdrawal of heavy weapons, and disengagement from the line of contact. The brave monitors of the OSCE have the full support of the United States. Mr. Toner said, "We condemn in the strongest terms all acts of hostility and intimidation toward the OSCE monitors. They must also have safe, full, and unfettered access throughout the conflict zone." The United States again calls upon Russia to use its influence with the separatists to take the first step toward peace in eastern Ukraine and ensure a visible, verifiable, and irreversible improvement in the security situation. Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine remain an obstacle to improved relations with the United States. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spoke with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko by phone recently and reiterated the United States' firm commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Secretary Tillerson confirmed that sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control of the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine and fully implements its commitments in the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.